Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Sunday, the 2nd of March 2003, and once again Gerard Houllier's Liverpool were back at Cardiff's Millennium Stadium, this time against the bitterest of rivals, Alex Ferguson's Manchester United. Due to bad weather conditions, the game would be played with the stadium roof closed, the first time in English football that a final was played indoors. The sealed environment only added to the intense atmosphere as a Steven Gerrard thunderbolt deflected off David Beckham and into the top corner. A man of the match performance from Jerzy Dudek kept the United barrage at bay until the 86th minute, when Michael Owen streaked onto Dietmar Hamann's through ball to slot past Fabian Barthez and put the game to bed. Flanked by Jamie Carragher, captain Sammy Hippier lifted Liverpool's 7th League Cup trophy aloft.
Right, Chris, take us back. Summer 2002, Liverpool had finished 2nd in the Premier League.
Yeah.
It was a big summer of transfer business, and it's one that kind of goes down in infamy, really.
Infamy, definitely. What I remember, really, at the end of 2002... we had a really good end to that season. There was kind of, an Elker had come in on loan. There'd been the kind of whole thing, I don't know, about Robbie going. Was it a good decision? And then an Elker comes in and everyone's immediately moving on. And an Elker, I think everyone really took to an Elker. And then for whatever reason, well, the reasons were, I think there was a feeling that an Elker was, whilst pledging himself to Liverpool, negotiating with other clubs. But the truth of that, we'll never know, probably. I think an Elker's version of the story is very different, and he always says he would have signed for Liverpool. But anyway, I think the suspicion is Liverpool had the Elhadj Diouf deal, should we say, sort of already lined up through the former assistant manager, Patrice Berg, who was the Lawns manager at the time. Was it Leo Lawns? We're another friend, I think it was Lawns. So they pressed ahead with Diouf, and then when the World Cup started, everyone was made up, weren't they? Because it was like, you know, Senegal was superb in that Japan. I was actually in Japan for that World Cup, getting the phone call, I think. I'm not sure the timeline exactly, whether or not Liverpool knew he was already joining, or it had been announced he was joining before that game, whether it was hurriedly revealed after they beat France in the opening game. And Salif Diouf was going to be the midfield enforcer as well, wasn't he? Like kind of Vieira-esque, you know, centre, you know, midfielder. And the plan was, this is going to be the final missing pieces of the jigsaw that's going to take Liverpool from second in 2002 to that final step. And there was just a hell of a lot of optimism around. You know, there'd been just that upward trajectory all the way through from when Gerrard took over, you know, 98, difficult start. The 2001 treble was obviously the real moment in terms of validation for Gerard Houllier and his methods. Then, of course, we have the, you know, the most tragic moments when he almost, you know, loses his life. And I think we can now look back in retrospect as to what effect that had on him. And he, you know, he very honest, you know, he spoke about that himself. But I think when in the summer of 2002 and 2000, moving to 2003, that kind of sense of awareness of what was going on with him hasn't really come out in the public yet, as people maybe behind the scenes are getting a little bit concerned, maybe not so concerned in 2002, but starting to wonder about certain decisions that are going to be taken. And that's the kind of period we are in Liverpool history, really, where it feels in the summer of 2002 Liverpool are about to make that next step. But unfortunately, perhaps the train is already in motion and it's going to go on a different path.
What do you think Liverpool's sort of mission statement would have been as far as transfers that summer? Obviously, they want to make that final step, but Littmanen leaves on a free. Never really kind of reached the peaks that people sort of hope. Barnby moves on as well. And in the place you get Diouf, Diaw, Cheyrou are the big ones coming in.
I think there was always a sense that Liverpool were a team that were tough to beat. You know, a kind of... The ongoing criticism of Gerard Houllier's team, and it'll always persist, really, is that they were more functional than flamboyant. And, you know, Arsenal were obviously the team everybody wanted to look like at that time. You know, United as well, but, you know, yeah, Arsenal had that kind of... Because there was such an obvious comparison with Arsene Wenger, and he and Gerard were such good friends. And it did rankle with Gerard, I know it did, you know, that he felt, you know, he wasn't getting enough credit for grinding out victories and just getting the winning machine going, because it was always wanting... There's just a feeling you want a bit more. The Liverpool way, so to speak, is a little bit more of a... But you know, we can talk about it now. It's what we see every week with the Jurgen Klopp side, and people were wanting that 20 years ago as well. And so I think that these players, Cheyrou was, you know, we could take the mick, can't we? And we know how Cheyrou was described. He was compared to like a kind of Zidane type midfielder, wasn't he? Diouf was going to add that kind of. Well, Diouf was signed as a striker. He ended up becoming a winger because he couldn't play up front in the Premier League. But at the time, it was him or Anelka. And so he was signed to number nine. He was given the number nine shirt. And it was just going to be that sense that you were going to have still that steel, but a little bit more, you know, silk as well. And that was going to be the difference to, you know, get those extra 10 points. I think they got 6 or 7 more points in 2002 or something. They probably would have been even closer. So... Do you really look stumped for another 10 points on top of the 2002 and to think we might get that title, you know?
You mentioned it before. Where was Houllier at physically and mentally in the build-up to this season?
Well, he wasn't right. I mean, there's no question about it. It's difficult to sort of say that at the time. You're in the bubble of, you know, competitive high elite, you know, Premier League. And a lot of people had said... I think quite openly, it was too soon for him to come back, and he was determined he was going to come back. I think he spoke out against people who dared suggest he shouldn't come back. And from my perspective, I was obviously covering the cover of Liverpool Echo. It was just business as usual, making judgments based on what you see and on the pitch and what you know, still in the privilege at that time, going to the training ground every morning. And I can look back in 20 years on and think, God, you know, how could you have not took a step aside and just, this, you know, if the reporting had taken a different tone then about, you know, we really should cut this fella a bit more time and space here, he's clearly not right. I don't think that would have washed with people anyway, you know, and he wouldn't have liked it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a big job he had, and he wanted to keep it, and he you know, he was determined to do it, and he was very brave. You know, it was incredibly brave, actually, when you look back, of him to do that. But, you know, I think he said it more than anybody, really, that he started to... I think up until then, his judgment had been pretty flawless on some major calls. I mean, even subsequent to the you know, that game against Leeds, it was that he sold Robbie. I mean, I think Robbie was already probably going to be sold. But then to bring Anelka in, it looked like a masterstroke, but it just perhaps... You know, just some of the critical faculties just deserted them just when he needed to make that extra step.
Yeah. I mean, the season starts really well for Liverpool. They kind of pick up where they left off. And we kind of mentioned Aladji Diouf. He's pilloried now and beyond pilloried. He's probably one of the few players that are borderline hated, actually, by Liverpool's fan base, having moved on. There's no redemption arc for him there, but he starts really well. He scores 2 goals in his home debut at Southampton, and it did look off the back of the World Cup like Liverpool actually had bought a really good player.
I think a lot of the problem with Diouf, more cultural in terms of how he fitted into the club and the ethos of the club and the dressing room at the time, it was a very solid dressing room, you know. You had that kind of real spine to it, and the lads who'd come in from overseas, Didi and Stefan Ancho, Sammy, it never felt there was any kind of cliqueiness, you know, with the younger lads, like you had Stevie Carter, Michael Owen, Danny Murphy, you know, and it all kind of really was well together. Obviously, Gary McAlee even would have been around, would he have quit in 2002? Yeah. That would have been a major loss to the dressing room, his kind of just wisdom and influence and experience as well. Because Stevie, I think, had a difficult 2002-2003, I mean, you know, again, my memory's blurred, but I think it may have been in the aftermath of the ball game that Gerard made a few critical comments about Stevie, which he documented as well later. Things were just sort of a little bit not quite the same. And then this guy comes in full of bling, you know. I think the lads sort of said, I think it sort of exploded with some of the autobiographies that come out, didn't they, where players made their feelings of what they thought of him known, and he's retaliated. But I think as a player, he's not as bad a player as people kind of remember. Liverpool have had far worse. You know, when I see lists and say, we're signing Liverpool this year, I just joke. I think, no, you're having a laugh. He was a good player. He just wasn't Liverpool standard player. You know, he had a very good career. I think he was excellent for Bolton. He nearly got Bolton in the Champions League. So you can't say he was a bad player. He just wasn't the... He certainly was no Anelka. He was no Nicholas Anelka, and he was no number nine for Liverpool. And, of course, from our vantage point in 2022, and you know what a real Liverpool number nine is, it looks even worse for Geoff, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. They go unbeaten in the first 12 league games of the season. But then November, it just looks like almost overnight the wheels come off.
This is one of the bad decisions that I think there was a game at Middlesbrough, and I know for a fact that the priority that day was to not lose.
Jeremy Dizza hits it. Oh! What a goal! Borough ahead at Anfield. Well, Borough have not scored away from home since the 28th of September. They've only scored four away from home all season.
That is an absolute peach. That is an absolute wonder goal. I tell you what, Dudek, I mean, never in a month of Sundays did he expect that Jeremy could put it in that little corner. Absolute wonderful strike.
There was some kind of record at stake, whether it was Premier League era, if Liverpool could go unbeaten for so long. And he played Danny Murphy in a kind of, I don't know, like a false nine even, or whether he was up front on his own or he played in as a number, kind of number 10. I don't know the exact team, but it was a very strange team. It was like, what's he doing here? And it backfired. And it seemed to be the trigger for this terrible run, which they did from thinking they were title contenders. I think by the time the League Cup final had come around, they were way out of it. I mean, they were out of Champions League. It ended very prematurely, and the title chance had gone. I think it was all coming to top four, as I recall.
Yeah, well, they lose to Middlesbrough, as you mentioned, on the 8th of November. They then didn't win a league game until the 18th of January, which was an 11-game stretch. Mm. And you mentioned the Champions League in that as well. They crash out of the Champions League and fall into the UEFA Cup. Yeah. Having drawn to Basel in the last game of the group. But one little interesting side note in this is obviously they come up against Rafa Benitez's Valencia.
Yeah, I remember both games.
Who put on a footballing display in those games.
Dura Torres. Albelda. Aymar. On by Baraka. Terrific move. Wonderful goal. Pablo Aymar. It has been coming. Here is Peru. Into the path of Baraka. 2-0. Ruben Baraka doubles Valencia's lead.
Yeah, I remember both games. They absolutely battered Liverpool. And it was another moment where you saw a little glimpse of the future. Now the game was perhaps changing and Liverpool were not... Liverpool were static. You know, Liverpool's attempt to sort of change and evolve a little bit had backfired. And even what they were good at previously now, which was that solidity and the ability to get a one, you know, a nil-nil in the new camp and stuff, that had gone as well. And I do vividly recall those Valencia games because you kind of thought this is the football Liverpool should be playing. You know, they had Pablo Aymar and a fella called Mister up front and everyone was... I do remember, it's easy to say this now, but everyone, who's this manager? Who's this Valencia manager? You know, and Valencia was sort of taking on Real Madrid and Barcelona, and the two coaches who were emerging and everyone was talking about was Benitez and Mourinho at Porto, because what was going on at Porto as well. And it was kind of then a case of, I think it would be premature to say by 2003 people were starting to wonder whether or not Gerrard was going to get sacked, because I think there was always going to be, that was never going to happen after one dodgy season, if you like. But certainly 12 months later, it was pretty obvious by March that Benitez was on Liverpool's radar. I mean, I'm not sure whether it was David Moyes or Rick Parry who were leading that, by the way. There was intermediaries who were waiting on Liverpool's behalf who were very much in the ear of the Liverpool board and saying, you've got to keep your eye on what's going on in Spain, definitely.
Would that have been an eye-opener for the board, though, those
games? Definitely, yeah, definitely. Definitely. But they were very, you know, supportive board, weren't they? I mean, David Moyes was never, ever going to want to sack a manager unless he had absolutely no choice, especially not Gerrard, after what he'd gone through. So I don't have any recollection at all during that run of there being a feeling of the manager being under pressure for his position. That came 12 months later, really. There would have been a few alarm bells with how poor the new signings had been, and it seems to be a constant trying to reassure everybody, you know, these players will come good, they need time. Always quoting players, it was always about Robert Pires needed time. That seems to be a constant story, didn't it? You know, look how long it took Pires to settle and players didn't settle, and you kind of think, you know, it didn't take them that long, actually, you know. I think it was obvious those three players were a write-off, really, 6 months in. I mean, I think everyone had given up on them. Certainly the players in the dressing room had given up on some of them knew after a few training sessions, to be honest.
Well, it's interesting because I guess it's kind of alluded to, but Jamie Carragher has been very outspoken, more so in recent years, I guess, with a bit of time and distance. But it strikes me, as you mentioned there, he's one of the players who just wasn't won over by.
It's like anybody when you're playing, whether you're playing with your mates or whether you're playing, obviously they're at a completely different level. You can see who's good. It's only going to have a bad training session. They could have maybe a few bad training sessions, but after a couple of weeks, you know who's class, don't you? It's pretty obvious who's class. And you don't see players really go from not being very good to, or being average, to being world beaters in a couple of weeks. And Liverpool were looking at those prices at that time. You'd expect it to be world beaters who were going to make the difference, and it was disappointing, really.
Yeah. What were Liverpool's main issues during this time? Because I guess the inquests would have been getting bigger and bigger as the weeks progressed and the wins just weren't coming.
I think it was to do with the inability to make that transition from a side that played a very pragmatic style of defensive side of counter-attacking football, grinding results out a lot of the time, to one which was more front-footed. Liverpool were they were a powerful, strong unit when they were at the best. But they did allow the other team to have a lot of the ball. Yeah, made no bones about that, you know. And there was always talk about the fullbacks. I mean, Carragher would have been playing fullback around that in that era, and he was always getting stick for not being Ashley Cole or whoever. It was the flavour of the month, you know. We had the midfield was Didi. Stevie was still sometimes playing centre mid, sometimes playing wide. He obviously wanted to be the centre midfielder, but when he did play there were issues which I don't think really ever got solved until Rafa took over, about how do you let him run riot and have the freedom and still have the protection? So as he moves into centre midfield, there's probably less protection for the back four. And, you know, Marcus Babbel had been a pivotal figure and he had problems. And I think this may have been his last season at Liverpool. He didn't play at all. I think he may have played one game and got taken off because he was just so off it. Jonathan Risa would have come in, and he was the kind of attacking fullback everyone was looking for, but he wasn't as strong defensively. So it kind of was just getting the balance, probably. If my recollection was that the balance has gone, not quite sure what they want to be anymore. It's probably become a bit more confused, and some of the creative sparks, such as Lippmann, who was only playing cameos, but he was still adding that little extra bit of class, and Gary Mack, who was just able to be a set piece, you know, king and creative, but also was a tough, you know, tough midfielder as well as his midfielder as well. He was like, you know, if Liverpool would only have signed Gary McAllister when he was 25, you know. And that's probably what they were, you know, you have to look back now. Maybe that was underestimated a lot more.
I suppose there's a thing there where the players you're mentioning there, there's two guys in their 30s, yeah, and they're being brought, and the players who are being brought in are, yes, they're younger and you imagine fresher, and you know, and that's obviously a thing, but there's a lot of experience that's lost from that.
Yeah,
from that
habits,
squad.
Good habits, good. Yes, they use that phrase now, it's a bit of a cliche now, and a good culture of a good dressing. From something when I was saying earlier about the culture, it's like, you know, you've got somebody. You're going from Babel to Lippmann and McAllister, who, you know, Bayern Munich, Barcelona, Gary Mack, you know, to two guys who still young lads as well, Juff and Jow, you know, and a hell of a lot of pressure on them. They didn't really know what probably hit them, I wouldn't have thought. It was too much of a burden for them to carry, and they just didn't have the equipment they needed to do it.
It's a tough time for Michael Owen, actually, in this period as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I do remember. I think it was Ball, he missed a few chances. I think he was getting a bit of stick, but I think he still would have only been 22, 23, but the injuries probably had taken a yard off him already, so, and again, he was expected to sort of deliver every single game, and Heskey was in a very inconsistent spell. I think patience was wearing thin a little bit with Heskey again, because he was seen as a little bit more of the batter and ram. You know, people wanted Lippmann to succeed, and because they had a vision of Liverpool with Lippmann and then, you know, the 10, you know, behind an Owen. And Heskey was kind of what Liverpool had needed to make the little step up, but was not going to, in many supporters' minds, be the one who's going to get them the title. So
you got Barros floating around on the periphery.
Barros had just come through. He was like, he looked an exciting prospect at the time as well. Yeah, he, I remember a couple of games he was just sensational. But he was always a bit hit and miss, though. That was the trouble, wasn't it, with Barros? He was erratic. He could be great one. You know, the sign of greatness really is, you're going to deliver 8 out of 10 games, or is it going to be 2 out of 8 games? You know, and Barros was unfortunately more 2 and 8, wasn't he? And yeah, so it was a kind of a transitional period, if you like, at a time when people thought the transition was over.
Yeah. Liverpool, the League Cup Story is a 5-part premium podcast series. If you wish to stream the entire series, it is available right now exclusively on Redmen Plus. Head to theredmentv.com and sign up for all of those episodes in video or in podcast form in your native podcast player. In episode 1, Tony Evans, author and former sports writer for The Times, discusses Liverpool's first 4 League Cup wins from 81 to 1984. In episode 2, former Express and current journalist John Keith discusses the Steve McManaman final in 1999. In episode 3, it is the Worthington Cup final 2001, first part of a famous treble with Tony Evans. Episode 4 is the 2003 win over Manchester United with The Telegraph's Chris Bascom. And finally, episode 5, the 2012 League Cup final win over Cardiff City with The Athletic and formerly of the Liverpool Echo, James Pearce. Check out that full series streaming right now on Redmen Plus. Head to theredmentv.com to gain full access right now.
The League Cup becomes a bit of a, you know, a sort of, I don't know, a lifeline for Liverpool's season in some regards. Yeah. When they get into January and things have really sort of collapsed in the Premier League, they've got Sheffield United to like semi-final, and even that threatens to come undone.
Yeah, that was Neil Warnock, wasn't it, though?
Yeah.
That was a hostile, that first game, that first leg, it was pretty hostile.
Murphy to take. Jow in there too, with some big men Liverpool. And one of those big men is there, Hooky, they score. Miller puts the ball in, and Liverpool lead at Bramall Lane. Free kick for Sheffield United, edge of the area is Alisson. It might get dropped to Tom here, and Tom's in with a chance for Sheffield United, and scores! Through the legs of the keeper, Sheffield United are level in the semi-final. And Murphy was up there, and Tom again. He can't go do it again, can he? He can, you know, he can. It's his night. It's Michael Tong, and it's 2-1 Sheffield United. This semi-final has been turned on its head.
They were there to kick the shit out of Liverpool that night, you know, and they had some tough players. I think Michael Brown may have played for them, and he was You know, he left his foot in. And it was a proper atmosphere there, and it was tough. And I think to get out of it, it was 2-1, was it?
Mm-hmm.
I think 2-1 in the end was a good result, because I don't think Liverpool played particularly well. And yeah, there were all kinds of shenanigans going on. You know, Warnock was at his most Warnock. And the best thing about it was the sense of, got to go back to Anfield now. But it was, they had a decent, you know, they were in that image of a kind of what Allardyce's teams would become. And those kind of, Liverpool have always tended to struggle against those kind of sides anyway, the best of times. But it was, I think they were, they had some decent players, Sheffield. I don't know whether Jagielka would have been part of the round.
It's possible, actually, because they've got,
before his time.
Well, it's Melody who opens the score, and then Michael Tong, who's one of them, who's very much a name of that
he
era.
He was getting linked with Liverpool every week, him. I don't know, I don't remember the interest being actually real on. I certainly don't remember reporting Liverpool were interested in him, but I remember seeing it a lot. I think he was at Ari. He's just one of those guys who sort of had a good 6-7 months, didn't he? And nobody, I don't know what became of him really, but it was a tough game that night, I remember. And the second leg it set it up for a proper, you know, war in the second leg. I think the crowd were right up for it.
United's brave Worthington Cup adventure was ended at Anfield as the cliff-hanging semi-final went into extra time. Michael Owen's shot was parried by Kenny. Heskey found Diouf to crack in Liverpool's opener. Then the game's controversial moment. Chris Kirkland lucky to stay on the field after handling the ball outside of the box. Tommy Mooney's free kick was hit well enough, but the Liverpool wall did its job. Then Gerrard's pass found Michael Owen, an international class from the striker, secured Liverpool's place in Cardiff.
Owen scoring the win. In fact, Diouf scores the first goal, goes to extra time on aggregate, and then Owen scores the winner.
Stefan Encho went for Warnock. Stefan Encho, the most mild-mannered, nicest bloke, never got into... I don't know if you've ever got see him getting booked, even when he handles the ball. The people didn't see it, you know. Yeah. And he went for Warnock at the end. He just, like, really screamed at him, like, you know, it was... Because I think they'd been really riled by this kind of old-school alehouse approach of Sheffield United, and the cultured Stefan had had enough.
What was the feeling there? Is that, I mean, I guess initially there's just jubilation winning a football match under the kind of that kind of environment and what have you. How was it sort of perceived at the time? Was it, I don't know, an example of Liverpool changing their fortunes, or maybe paper over the cracks?
I can only speak from my own memory of it, that it was pretty overlooked. I think it's overlooked now, and I think it was pretty overlooked then. I think it was almost, people have forgotten how difficult it is to win a trophy, any trophy. The treble had just happened. There was just a huge, much more expense sense of expectation. It is a cliche, but it is a classic case of a side, you know, making a rough for its own, batting away because they've heightened expectations upon themselves now. Okay, great that you won that treble. Now go on, you're going to do something more now. Oh, it's another League Cup. No, that's not what we want. So there wasn't that sense of excitement as there had been 2 years earlier when they got to the League Cup final, when it was, this is the first step Liverpool needs. You've got to get that first trophy under your belt, and it's going to set up everybody off. It was a bit ho-hum, unfortunately, by 2003. But having said that, a Wembley final against Man United, you're never going to be without a certain level of, you know, excitement, and you know, everyone going there to win. And I think it parks all the difficulties of the league campaign and what may be ahead. But no, I do have a sort of feeling that a little bit taken for granted, perhaps. Yeah. You know, that it's difficult to get to a Wembley final, and Liverpool have been there not very frequently in the League Cup since, but at that time, twice in 3 years, oh well, that's just what, that's, you know, okay, but we still want you to win the title. Don't think this is going to get you anything, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, it's Manchester United who themselves had a couple of issues getting through. They managed to beat Blackburn to book their place. Just contextually, Manchester United at this time, can you speak to just what their dominance and quality were?
Yeah, but I think Liverpool finished above them the previous year. But that was what United sort of just had that capacity to just be good, competing every year, which is what Liverpool was striving for. It wasn't just like one title bid and then disappear for 4 years, which unfortunately Liverpool were in that era of averaging one title bid every decade, it felt, you know. And so they were very familiar. That was this is the Ruud van Nistelrooy Man United, isn't it? It's so dangerous in every, you know, every area they could. The totally different style to Liverpool, which I think Liverpool supporters at the time turned a blind eye to a little bit. Didn't want to acknowledge they were playing the football that you wanted to see at Anfield. You know, Ferguson was the risk taker. Ferguson was the one who was always going to try and score three and not care if you scored two. Well, maybe not care, but he was always going to be a gambler and end up with four or five strikers on the pitch if needs be. Whereas Liverpool, if they were going to win, it was going to be solid defence, counter-attack, hit them on the break, protect what you've got and cause them the tactical problems. And that is exactly how that game, in my memory, turned out. It was Liverpool back to the Liverpool 2001. Back to basics, if you like. Relying on Owen on the break and, you know, the pace of you know, Stevie bursting through and stuff like that. And I think it was one of those games, the final, where everything went exactly to the tactical strategy beforehand, yeah.
Yeah, so just in the build-up to this game, you know, the final itself, I mean, out of interest, obviously, to return to Cardiff, which Liverpool had great memories from the treble season, that's the first game to be played under the roof at Cardiff as well. Like, just a very unusual sort of atmosphere for a football match to take place.
Yeah, I think that would have helped Liverpool as well. You know, the fact they'd been there a few times, loved it, fans loved it. Atmosphere was superb in that Millennium Stadium.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry, and some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs. UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Scousers, every, you know, Man United fans won't agree with this, but you know, there's kind of Liverpool fans were louder, you know, and yeah, I think the good memories of that, and when you've been so recently. I mean, I don't know what Liverpool's overall record in Cardiff was, but it feels as though it was a lot. They won a lot more than they lost. I mean, I include they played Charity Shield matches there as well and won. So that would have felt a good vibe. I think there probably would have been a real sense of freedom for the players going there. They'd have to speak about that more. But, you know, when you go somewhere, you've got good memories, it always helps, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And Man United come into this game, they've just beaten Juventus 3-0 in the Champions League. And there is a bit of as to your point, not necessarily having won the league or whatever in the previous season, but they carry a fear factor with them, with the perception of being very much Liverpool as underdogs in this game.
Definitely, except there would have been the Liverpool-Man United factor. It is a derby, you know, so there wouldn't have been any anticipation from United's end that this is going to be, they're gone, they're on the way down. I think they would have realised it was going to be exactly as it was. And of course, don't forget, I think this may have been in the midst of this prolonged unbeaten run Liverpool had against United. Maybe they'd just ended that, I don't know, but there was definitely a period where Liverpool might have been 8 or something games unbeaten against Man United.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because the game that had preceded the last time they played was in December, and it's the now infamous Diego Forlan.
Okay, so
Jerzy Duda.
Right.
Carragher. Oh, the goalkeeper's lost it. What a catastrophe for Dudek. What a gift for Forlan and for Manchester United. In such a tight game, it's been broken open in extraordinary circumstances. Oh, it's through. It's Forlan again. It is Forlan again. His first away goals for Manchester United. There are two of them now.
That's something that kind of feeds into this. And do that in particular, because obviously it's a catastrophic sort of moment for Dudek in that game. What was the sort of perception around the goalkeeper around this time?
Well, up until 2002, Dudek was, I don't think I can remember many mistakes. He came back from the World Cup and there was a feeling that he was fatigued, wasn't he, mentally fatigued after the World Cup? He suddenly started making these strange mistakes, and that was the most noticeable that game. I think people just kind of thought he was having a bit of a blip, that there was nothing too much to worry about with him. And he just, you know, it wasn't any dissimilar to how it is now, the whole debate about players and having time off. But I can remember when Jerzy came in, he just seemed to be such a calm goalkeeper. And he was much of a, you know, he was a massive upgrade on Sander Westerveld. But he had started to make these errors. So I can't imagine there would have, I'm sure there would have been focus on the fact he was facing United again. But I'm not sure there would have been as much concern. I don't think anyone was thinking, oh, Liverpool got a bad goalkeeper, he's a weak link. Nobody ever thought that about Jerzy. Even when he got replaced, he was, you know, this is a guy who left the Liverpool and joined Real Madrid. Let's not forget. So he wasn't bad, was he?
There's some really interesting quotes from a couple of the players in the build-up to this. Vladimir Smicha says, I hope that this reignites our season. Our season is not good, we know, but there's still plenty to play for. We have not said this is a bad season. Let's forget about it and concentrate on the next one. Mm-hmm. We've been criticised and we are intent on responding on the pitch. And Danny Murphy said, winning in Cardiff would be massive for us. We have to be honest, we haven't been as good as Manchester United over the last 10 years, and winning would bring European football next season, which isn't guaranteed at the moment. That's actually, I think that's a really interesting one as well, contextually, because this is, of course, a period where winning a League Cup was, you know, just being able to tick the European box, you know, and having European football guaranteed was an added pressure.
Definitely that would have been it, because I'm sure, I don't know whether it was top three or top four on the Champions League that season, but it must have been a huge concern already, having started the season at the top, that already Chelsea would have been either above or close to Liverpool. And Leeds are obviously in the hunt around there as well, Arsenal, United. So, yeah, I think just to be in Europe at all would have been massively significant. It just takes a little bit of the pressure off. It just feeds into the whole thing. You know, obviously, those quotes obviously show the sense of disappointment that's already around the club by this stage of the season, that the title bids have faltered completely and they're already thinking of next year, how they're going to compete for the title.
Yeah.
I hesitate to say the word, but I do have a personal memory of being the Echo were banned. Liverpool had drawn 2-2 with Arsenal. It was a famous game where Thierry Henry runs past Carra, and I think that was the final straw. I think they felt that our coverage was too critical, and we were allowed back in the day before the final. But I think that just again shows, you know, in the bubble of what was going on at the time, you know, I mean, I don't know whether it was justified. I can't imagine it was justified, the ban, but, you know, equally, you know, when people are under pressure, then you think you do, you know, you're on their side. I mean, I always think it's just ironic. I only mention that because, you know, you do read lots of, people are always accusing the Echo of just writing whatever Gerard who they wanted and stuff, you know. But to be honest, he didn't know what was going on, you know. But I think we're all happy and back in to the fold on the Friday, and even more so on the following Monday, probably taking photographs and doing interviews after they were parading the cup.
Well, I was going to
all kissed and made up.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, is that, so that adds to me just in terms of personal feelings and what have you on the day. what's up, you know, have you any particular personal memories or whatever of going to the game?
I think it's just, you know, at the Liverpool correspondent, the Liverpool Echo, I don't know what Liverpool supporters buying the Echo at the time expected or what anyone who wasn't Liverpool, whatever Evertonians expected, but it was pretty much the same for Liverpool and Everton, right? Yeah, it was pretty obvious who you were behind, but you were still trying to do it in an impartial way. But in terms of, you wanted them to win, obviously. And you, it made your job a hell of a lot easier when the team's successful. It really does, you know. I think I probably was just... It sounds like it's just funny thing to say. There's so many... It's such a privilege because you can remember so many finals now. And different reactions. You know, some of them stand out more than any. I can't actually remember how I felt after the 2003 final because I can remember how I felt after the treble. And I can remember in Istanbul, and I can remember in Kiev, I can remember in Kiev when they lost, but I can remember in Madrid. But the 2003, it probably shows you where it is for a lot of supporters, that whether it was relief or whether it was kind of ho-hum or whether it was, oh, brilliant, this is going to mean we're not banned anymore. I can't really remember. And I think that may be where this final fits in. Whereas for another club, 2000, just, you know, they might just have to commemorate that every year. Liverpool have so many commemorations and anniversaries, don't they? And, you know, some of them clearly eclipse this one.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because I think to the point there, you know, Liverpool against their biggest rivals in a final, they win.
Yeah.
And there's no, like, when we were chatting beforehand, you know, look at the Alaves UEFA Cup finals, an absolute nightmare of an experience to kind of get through and get through it ultimately. The Arsenal FA Cup final, hard work. Cardiff in the League Cup final, you know, made much harder work than it should have been. United have Jerzy Dudek wins man of the match, which gives you a decent indication of the sort of ebb and flow of the match to some extent. But is it just odd that this isn't sort of held up in higher esteem because of who it was?
It is odd, but I suspect it's just more to do with what immediately came before and what immediately comes after. So it's not, I think there's been a lot of positive retrospective feelings about the 2001 treble, which for a long time got overlooked because of what happened in Istanbul. And I think, you know, a lot of the lads, you know, Kadir's chief amongst them, is basically said to be, we should celebrate that season far more than is. And I think that is celebrated much more, it feels, in the last 4 or 5 years than it had been the previous 10 or 15. And maybe it's the same with this. It's difficult for people to sort of look at it as fondly because 2001 meant so much more to them. And there's always that knowledge in the back of your head that it's the beginning of the end, or in the middle of the beginning of the end of the Houllier era, and Rafa takes over. I think if Rafa had beaten Chelsea in 2005... that would probably be held in greater esteem than even in 2003, just because it felt as though this is the start of something.
Yeah.
Whereas this is coming really at the end of something, isn't it? And I think it's probably just purely to do with that. But I'm sure for the lads who were playing, it for me it feels just as good as it. Man United, they've only... How many times have Liverpool beaten Man United in the major domestic final? I mean, there's the 83 one as well, isn't there? So... it's definitely not something to be, and a great Man United team as well, you know, not the Man United of the last few years, one of the, you know, a team that's going to go on to win the European Cup again, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. The just on the game itself, Steven Gerrard scores a deflected screamer to kick things off.
Gerrard going for it, deflected! In! Liverpool get the lead, it's a pile driver from Gerrard, it was helped by the deflection, but what a big moment that is!
Well, I thought Mason was going to cross it, he decided not to, and as David Beckham goes to close down, Steven Gerrard, I thought there was coming in, Rob, he didn't take that, but David Beckham goes to close it down, that's what takes it past Partey, there's not a doubt about that, he strikes it well enough, but that's unsavable.
Yeah. I can't help but imagine the let off from that one was significant.
Definitely, yeah. Because I think that was an interesting season for Stevie. I don't know whether or not. Was he captain? Is he captain yet? Yeah. I can't remember.
No, don't
he's
so.
He's about to become captain.
I think Tippier lifts it.
So it's that period where, as I say, he's now being looked upon to become, from the young lad, the prodigy, to becoming the leader. and he's not quite there yet. And it's difficult. I think there's a little bit of a difficult relationship between him and the manager at that moment, that time, just for a brief period, which mends itself very quickly. But yeah, I do think it was an interesting. And of course, what happens at the end of that season, I'm pretty sure, is the Abramovich take over. And I don't think much is ever said or made that the first real move for him is then. It's not 2004. And then everyone remembers more 2005. They had the first move when Ranieri was still. And that's when he, you know, I don't think he was ever really ready to leave that soon. So Liverpool get one more. But Liverpool lose to Chelsea that last game of the season. And who knows if they had beaten Chelsea, would Abramovich have gone ahead with the, you know, Phil Thompson said in his book, I think, that they were going to sign John Terry. Liverpool were going to sign John Terry if that takeover hadn't happened. So there's all kinds of madness going on with sliding doors, you know, what going to be. But Steve, he is about to emerge as, you know, in my opinion, the greatest Liverpool player ever. But he has to go through this kind of little slight drop. I don't know where. I don't really recall his levels being ever anything other than magnificent, but he was certainly getting a little bit of attention in terms of getting substituted earlier and a few comments from the manager at the time. And I think he's spoken about that as well quite a lot.
Yeah. And the game's ultimately put to bed. Dietmar Amman wins the ball, lays Michael Owen in.
Back towards Ferdinand, and Fabian Barthez is having to race back to goal here. It's Michael Owen. The chance to finish it here.
Counter-attack makes it 2-0. I imagine the place comes unglued.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. And that was just a classic Liverpool goal at that time, really. Just soaking up the pressure, solid. And then Michael's going to kill you on the break. Not dissimilar to Arsenal, really. And a brilliant finish as well, you know. It's a shame, you know. As you say, you must look back at that goal and think, and a few years later, I joined them. I mean, he is the hero of Liverpool for that split. And again, you know, it's a shame for Michael that these great moments he provided are somewhat cast aside, really. But again, a lot of that's to do with the greater moments still to come, you know.
It's a bit of a bittersweet season, really. And kind of in context now, we know that's the real high point of the campaign. Liverpool's league form doesn't recover. It recovers better than it certainly had done up until January, but it never gets back to the level that it was at the start of the season. And you kind of said this, if the start of the season is a continuation from 2001-02, then this is the beginning of what continues into 2003, right, yeah. 2004 and the end of
Julio. Yeah, unfortunately, it doesn't turn around. I mean, I suppose the big hope is that another kind of reboot, a little bit of a reboot in the summer. No major championships, so that kind of excuse of the post World Cup fatigue's gone, and let's see how it goes. And I think in October there was a defeat to Southampton at Anfield. Fellow called Brett Ormerod scored, and I'm pretty sure the first discussion is led in the boardroom at that night that maybe they need to start keeping an eye out, and some of the names. Some weird and wonderful names emerge, you know, as potential Liverpool managers. Gordon Strachan, I think Alan Kirbishley was a big flavour of the month. But fortunately, there were one or two people, you know, and I will mention that there's a guy sadly departed last year with COVID, Richard Green, who was a club lawyer at the time, massive. He and another agent were kind of as go-betweens to Valencia. Colin Pomford, who was Steve McManaman's agent. And I think once Rafa heard, Liverpool might be interested. The rest, as they say, you know. And it was sad, really, for Gerrard, you know. It didn't end particularly well. But he was a great man. And you know, it's quite sad that, you know, it ended quite badly in 2003-2004, but he really was not bitter at all. I mean, I think maybe in the immediate aftermath it was difficult for him, but he didn't hold any grudges at all about Liverpool. And, you know, it was great that, you know, people sort of, I think, felt that. I think he felt the love before he sadly passed away, and that was good because he did so much for Liverpool. And I do think you do have to re-look at this period. I certainly do a lot in the context of what had happened to him and what, how it may have been different. We'll never know, unfortunately, if he hadn't been affected by the illness, if he hadn't, you know, gone through what he did. Would decisions have been taken different? Would that trajectory have just continued as everyone expected? There was no reason to believe it wouldn't have done. That's why everyone was so desperate for him to come back. And he got that extra, he won another trophy, you know. And I think even as we speak now, he's won more trophies than Jürgen Klopp. No, he didn't win the big one, the big two. But, you know, that is a fact that we, you know, it's great that that's acknowledged, and his face will always be on that flag, won't it, on the cup, rightly so. And this trophy was a worthy trophy.
You have been listening to Liverpool, the League Cup Story, produced by Limitless Productions for Red Men Plus. It stars Paul Machin, James Pearce, Tony Evans, Chris Bascombe and John Keith. Editor was Tom Dutton. Producer, Tom Dutton. Sound technicians, James Doherty and Ivo Prokop. Editing assistants, James Doherty and Matty McLennan. Pre-production, Paul Machin and Tom Dutton. Graphic editor, James Clark. Talent manager, Steve Hoare. Runners, Tom Carr and Ivo Prokop. Liverpool, the League Cup Story, was produced by Limitless Productions for Red Men Plus 2022.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.